It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump and Democratic leaders addressed border security and the ongoing government shutdown last night. We'll find out where negotiations stand between Congress and the White House.
First, a proposed solar farm about an hour west of Madison is generating some controversy among local residents.
The 300-megawatt Badger Hollow project in western Iowa County would be one of the largest in the nation. Developers say when it's up and running, it could power more than 70,000 homes.
Opinions among landowners are split. Some like the income potential for hosting the panels and support the move away from fossil fuels. Others say the solar farm would be an eyesore, eliminate valuable farmland, and drive out residents.
Chris Hubick covers energy, transportation, and environmental issues for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, give us the basics of this proposed solar power utility scale project.
Sure. So the project is called Badger Hollow. It's a 300-megawatt solar farm. It's proposed for far western edge of Iowa County. That's about 15 miles west of Dodgeville, about an hour from Madison.
And talk about the scale of this project. This is, I mean, if you want bigger ones, you have to go to places like Nevada, right? This is big for Wisconsin.
This is very big, not just for Wisconsin. It would be the biggest in the Midwest. And yeah, like you say, there's a handful bigger ones, but they're in the desert of California, Nevada. There's one in Minnesota up in Chisago County that's 100 megawatts, but right now, the biggest in Wisconsin is about 2.5. So we're talking 100 times bigger than anything.
2.5 megawatts. This would be 300 megawatts. Wow. So, okay. So this is a big deal.
Yeah. 100 times or more bigger than anything we've seen.
And now who is building this project? And I know that may be a more complicated question than it sounds when it comes to the utility industry.
It is. Officially, the people behind the project is a company called Invenergy. They're based out of Chicago, and they're the largest independent, privately held renewable energy provider in North America. It's kind of a mouthful. But they've done dozens of wind and solar farms around the world, as well as a handful of battery storage projects and about a dozen natural gas plants. This will be their largest solar project.
But for somebody flipping a switch at home, they're not going to pay a bill to Invenergy.
No. And that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. Invenergy is a private developer, can build a wind farm or a solar farm and sell the electricity they generate into the market. And your provider, MG&E or Alliant or whoever, might buy some of that power, but you would never pay a bill to them. What complicates this a little bit is that Invenergy has agreed to sell half of the project once it's built to MG&E and Wisconsin Public Service Corp, or WPS.
So they have these pre-commitments to sell part of the project, and people are already lined up to buy the electricity, right?
Correct. Yeah. So Invenergy will keep half of it and sell that energy either through a contract or in the wholesale market. But these two utilities will then buy half of it, and they will own it just like they would a coal plant.
Now, you talk to a lot of people, stakeholders in this story at one level or another, and I want to start on the farms of Iowa County. Can you talk a little bit about the farmers and the people you talk to who will be renting, I guess, their land, in effect, for this project?
Sure. There's not a whole lot. There's maybe two dozen farmers or landowners who've agreed to rent some portion of their land out for this. It might be 40 acres or 160 acres in some cases. And for them, this is a pretty good deal. Invenergy is paying, by most reports, $700 an acre. That's per year. That's about five times the average rent for cropland in Wisconsin.
And farmers, the economic situation they're facing, depending on what they're producing, say milk and other commodity prices, not very high. A lot of people going out of business. This might be an attractive opportunity for some farmers.
Sure. Yeah. Dairy farmers have been struggling for years. Even the crop farmers, they might have good years, but they have a lot of bad years where they're lucky to break even. This is a guaranteed source of income for 25 to 50 years.
And then for people who don't own that land, is there seen a, is there an economic benefit seen for local communities in Iowa County?
There is. The state law has a provision that, that Invenergy or any power producer like this would have to pay pay local government revenue. Works out to about $1.2 million a year for the county and the towns. So Invenergy has agreed also to replace some of the lost property tax revenue for the school district and other local taxation districts, because the land would be tax exempt, but there's payments in lieu of taxes.
And there isn't universal support in the communities involved. Some of the, especially it sounds like some of the neighbors of these projects are not necessarily on board here.
Correct. There's a lot of folks in the in that community who are not thrilled with it, either for personal reasons, because there's people whose land would be surrounded on one, two, or three sides by solar panels. Other folks have more general worries about the farmland. This is very good farmland being taken out of production for a couple of generations. They worry that there won't be enough land available for some of the bigger operators who need land to rent. And they worry that it'll just drive people away, that people will sign a contract and move to Florida, and other folks won't want to live around just a massive solar farm.
Talking to Chris Hubick with the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about a big proposed solar power, utility-scale solar power production zone in western Iowa County here in Wisconsin. Chris, what is the process for getting something like this approved? It's shorter in some ways than a lot of utility projects might be.
It could be. So it will require permission from the Public Service Commission. This is the three-member panel of utility regulators in the state. But because of the way that it's been proposed, it's a little bit different, since Invenergy has proposed this as what's called in the energy a merchant plant, meaning that they're not a rate-based utility who's going to stick their customers directly with the cost. So the bar for approval is a little bit lower in terms of what the PSC will look at in terms of the need and the engineering and the design. Then there's a separate case in which PSC is considering the utilities trying to buy this. But the two-step process, which is kind of happening in tandem, has raised some eyebrows among consumer advocates and others who just think that maybe the project won't get the same level of scrutiny as it would had the utilities just proposed this themselves.
Will this get any kind of environmental consideration? And do concerns like, I don't want to live next to a solar panel, is that something that somebody can object to?
So the PSC did, I don't want to call it cursory, but they did a fairly simplified environmental analysis looking at some of those issues surrounding it. A lot of the opponents of the project are sort of crying foul, and they want to see a more thorough investigation of the environmental impacts. There are a lot of unanswered questions in terms of what type of panels would be used, exactly how the panels will be sited. One of the big questions is what happens when the project reaches the end of its useful life. Mm-hmm. The owners are responsible for decommissioning, but they've proposed to wait 15 years before putting together a detailed plan and putting up money to take the panels out.
Do we have specific rules that say where you can site the solar panels? I remember a while back there were state laws put in place, I think, on wind turbines that say how close they could be to houses and things like that. Is there something like that for solar?
No.
No.
And that's one of the things that's confounded some of the opponents and neighbors. This is so new for Wisconsin on this scale that the PSC just hasn't developed rules. Some of the folks who are opposing it and have intervened in the process, kind of a technical term, but they have a vested interest in this. They have petitioned the PSC to make rules for this. Invenergy has objected, saying it's not really necessary. They're saying the PSC has enough tools to guide how they want to design this, but no, this is kind of uncharted territory.
This is the first solar plant on this scale in Wisconsin, first thing anything close to it. Would it be the last if it gets approved?
Very unlikely. There's already another one of similar size. I think it's 150 megawatts up near Manitowoc. That's in the application process right now with the PSC. If you look in what's called the planning queue, which is the folks who manage the grid, the power grid in the Midwest, they sort of keep track. Anybody who wants to do a big generation project has to apply and have a study to make sure that it's not going to throw everything off. If you look in there, there's two dozen projects proposed of 100 megawatts or bigger, up to 400 megawatts. So
all in Wisconsin or around
in Wisconsin?
Just
no,
in Wisconsin.
Just in Wisconsin. Not all of those are going to get built, but this is clearly a new reality here.
Sounds like we'll have you back to talk about some of those projects in the future. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Chris Hubbuck is an energy, transportation, and environmental reporter with the Wisconsin State Journal. We talked to him about the controversy over a proposed 300-megawatt solar farm in Iowa County.
Coming up, we explore what it means for children, especially children of color, when they don't have access to the same opportunities. Our guest is calling for a new deal for children of color. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump and congressional Democrats don't appear any closer to a compromise on funding a border wall after last night's televised speeches. We'll talk to a D.C. reporter about how lawmakers are trying to end the ongoing government shutdown.
First, when a child is born, his or her family likely hope for the best of them, or for them, for health, for education, for happiness, and more.
But according to our next guest, not every child has the same access to opportunity to reach their full potential. She says that in the U.S., children of color disproportionately feel the effects of poor educational results, poverty, and structural discrimination, and that equality isn't in the cards for all of our kids at this time.
Nancy Dowd is a professor and David Levin Chair in Family Law at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. She is the author of several books, including Reimagining Equality, A New Deal for Children of Color. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us. What exactly is developmental equality?
Well, in a nutshell, it means the idea that we would support the full developmental capacity of every child. So development then would be an equality right. If you want to imagine those kids in the nursery at the hospital, that we would say for every single one of those children who were born relatively cognitively equal, that we are going to equally support them as an equality right so that they come to the threshold of adulthood with the best possible opportunity to succeed as adults.
Why is it essential to children's growth and opportunity?
Well, remember, again, children are vulnerable. They are dependent on us.
Right.
And so they can't grow and develop without us. And the us is their families, their communities, and also all of us, all of society. So they are at our mercy, right?
Yeah.
And so are their families, so are their communities. So it's essential that they have the kind of inputs to bring that capacity that they are born with to its fullest fruition. And at the same time, if there are adversities along the way, unavoidable adversities, for example, that we would help them and support them and provide them with resilience to move through that adversity. But we wouldn't put blocks or challenges or adversities in their path. We wouldn't make things more difficult. And at the same time, we would be fully supporting them. And so it makes enormous, even if it's self-interested, human capacity. We would have a better society if everyone achieved their full developmental capacity. Because think of all the qualifications and rich capacity and skill they have as adults. So it's all good. It's not just that we're doing this out of because we care about kids, but also we care about ourselves
right.
as adults. It's to generate a better society.
Nancy, can you talk about the barriers that exist for children of color? And based on your research for your book, Black Boys, when it comes to equal development.
Yes, I think I can. Well, I throw out three critical markers. If you were to look at a black boy in the hospital right now, just born today,
right,
you would say, okay, he has a better than 1/3 chance to be born in poverty. He has only a 50% chance of graduating from high school, and he has a 1 in 3 chance. And in some areas, more than that, but at least a 1 in 3 chance of being incarcerated in his lifetime. So you take those three things, the impact of poverty, the impact of inadequate education, and the impact of incarceration, and that's a setup for failure, right? It's a funneling towards failure instead of a support for success. And it's a pattern of early adversity that gets not better but worse in school, that has some particular challenges in adolescence. And then there is this sort of irony that racial identity, in the sense of a pride and a sense of strength in terms of one's racial identity, is both a plus and a minus, right? Because of the degree of stereotype and biases interacts negatively with that very strength. So it's really a pattern for black boys in particular, but they aren't the only kids who are at the bottom of the ladder. But they are by looking at their life patterns, you go, wow, this is just hurdle after hurdle after hurdle. It doesn't mean that some don't succeed,
right?
But it's not what you would hope for any child, which is that we are helping and supporting them moving forward, and we don't put anybody in a better position, and we don't put a brick wall that has to be gone over or around or through in front of others.
Nancy Dowd is professor and David Levin chair at Family Law at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. And she's written a book called Reimagining Equality, A New Deal for Children of Color. And we're talking about how to make sure that all of our kids, regardless of color, succeed. Nancy, I want to share a personal story with you and then ask you a question. Now,
okay.
I grew up in Philadelphia, but I spent a year, my kindergarten year, in a suburb of Camden. And
mm-hmm.
I was one of only two African-American kids at that particular school.
Mm-hmm.
And about a few months in, we had received a letter from the teacher to take home for our parents to sign. And me, because I was fortunate enough to where my mom taught me how to read pretty well at a very young age. She started reading to me very, very early.
Mm-hmm.
I opened the letter and read it. And my mom picked me up. She usually did every day at the playground to walk me home. And she happened to be talking to my teacher and her assistant. And I said, Mom, you know, we're going to the museum or wherever it was. And the teacher looked at me and she asked me, how did I know that? And I told her I read it. And she looked at me and she said, no, you didn't. And I said, yeah, I read it. And then my mother looked at her and said, you know, my son can read. And she gave me the letter. She said, Darrell, read the letter. And so I read the letter in its entirety. And the teacher was shocked. Her and her assistant looked at each other. And I was in school for 5 months. And the teacher or her assistant never knew that I actually knew how to read. And that was 1973-1974 school year. And so my question to you is that some of the barriers that kids, especially black boys, are facing today? Has things really changed around the country as far as expectations are concerned?
Well, I think I would say probably some change, but it's remarkably disappointing that the the perceptions and the biases continue to persist. So the data would say would be consistent with your experience. For example, when you look at kids who are excluded from preschool and kindergarten, they are disproportionately kids of color and disproportionately boys. Same thing with if you are still, we're still looking at discipline patterns, exclusion patterns, assumptions of lack of capability, assumptions that kids of color, but particularly boys, are going to be a problem, and not perceiving them as kids of capability, of intellectual capability, of being at the and anywhere in the class, but particularly in the top of the class. So I think the data would tend to say to us that there has been a stagnancy in terms of cognitive bias, in terms of assumptions about kids, so that particularly for black boys, school makes things worse. In other words, whatever disadvantage is suffered from birth to five, right?
Right.
When you get to school, it doesn't get better. It isn't as if the kids come to the schoolhouse door and say, okay, let's evaluate where everybody is. All right, if they're not on this in the same place, let's get them to the same place, because that right. would be the idea that we can make things up. It's not as if it's etched in stone. Instead, the gaps widen, and they particularly widen in a way that is exacerbated by gender as well as race. So black boys are disproportionate. And then, mm-hmm. of course, you get discipline policies that start pushing them into the juvenile justice system. So it's again, this high school graduation rate, for example, is linked back to what's happening in elementary school.
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. Nancy Dowd is a professor and the David Levin Chair in Family Law at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. Her new book is called Reimagining Equality, A New Deal for Children of Color.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out where Congress and the White House stand on the ongoing partial shutdown of the federal government. I'm Rob Fair.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, we'll get analysis on President Trump's address to the nation last night and the Democratic response.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is reportedly planning to resign, but there are differing reports on when that might happen. House committees may hold hearings on a Medicare for All health care system. And President Trump addressed the nation last night to make the case for funding a border wall.
The president claimed illegal immigration was causing a humanitarian crisis at the southern border and that a wall is needed to protect Americans. He also blamed Democrats for the ongoing government shutdown.
Democrats in Congress have refused to acknowledge the crisis, and they have refused to provide our brave border agents with the tools they desperately need to protect our families and our nation. The federal government remains shut down for one reason and one reason only, because Democrats will not fund border security.
And our question for you this week, what did you make of President Trump's address and the Democratic response? Do you think a border wall is worth keeping parts of the government shut down? Should the president sign bills to fund the government and deal with border security later on? What kind of compromise, if any, would you like to see between Congress and the White House? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, President Trump, as we heard, putting the blame for the shutdown on Democrats. It's complicated by him in a televised statement talking with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi not too long ago, saying if a shutdown happened, he would own it. He would take responsibility for it. But we have this blame game going on.
Well, that's right. And we have this new development where the president just hosted Chuck and Nancy, as he likes to call them, at the White House just within the last hour, and posed a question to Nancy Pelosi saying, are you going to be with me on the border wall or not? And Nancy Pelosi said, no, I'm not. And the president said, bye-bye, and walked out of the meeting. Quite a development. It just goes to show sort of where these negotiations stand. There's been a lot of activity, but not really any sort of movement in terms of the two sides coming closer together to get a deal to reopen 25% of the government that's currently shut down. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of sort of shuttle diplomacy. The vice president was on Capitol Hill yesterday, meeting with fellow Republicans. Trump came to the Capitol today to urge Senate Republicans to stand firm and stand with him. But really, we're in the exact same position as we were 19 days ago when the shutdown kicked off, and not really much movement has happened.
And we heard a bit of President Trump speaking last night. Let's give a listen now. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer gave a response last night after the speech. Here's a bit of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
On the very first day of this Congress, House Democrats passed Senate Republican legislation to reopen government and fund smart, effective border security solutions. But the president is rejecting these bipartisan bills, which would reopen government, over his obsession with forcing American taxpayers to waste billions of dollars on an expensive and ineffective wall, a wall he always promised Mexico would pay for.
And you wrote, Scott, about the House Democrat approach to funding bills. What kind of things are they passing right now?
So right now, actually, as we speak, the House is voting on one of the appropriation bills that would help reopen financial services agencies. For people at home, that would be agencies like the IRS, which will be providing tax returns fairly soon. And so Democrats have argued unless the IRS is reopened, some tax refunds may be delayed. And obviously that would be a big impact on Americans' bottom line heading into tax season. So this week, Democrats, House Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, are bringing up one by one individual funding bills to help reopen some of these federal agencies. They want to really underscore the impact of the closures of these federal agencies, and they want to put additional pressure on Republicans, not only in the House, but especially those vulnerable Republicans in the Senate who will be up for reelection in 2020, as well as additional pressure on the president himself. And it seems to be working, this strategy of constantly passing these sort of clean funding bills that don't have President Trump's border wall attached, because you're starting to see cracks in this Republican unified wall. People like Cory Gardner of Colorado saying that he doesn't support the current shutdown and the president's shutdown strategy. Even in this lunch today with Senate Republicans, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine challenged the president and urged him to reopen the government because of the impact on federal workers and everyday Americans. So we're starting to see some cracks show in this Republican unification.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news this week. We invited your calls on the shutdown and border security, dueling speeches from the president and Democratic leaders from Congress. Alice joins us now in Sheboygan. Alice, hi, what do you think?
Hi, I happened to listen to an interview with Border Patrol on the news, and the gentleman that answered the phone, I was thrilled to hear what they had to say. I said, they're the boots on the ground, and they say the problem isn't more structure. The problem is more people doing what they're doing, meeting these people, talking to them. The human contact is what works best, and they're not asking for more structure. And then I am also concerned with friends who are waiting for paychecks, and the instability in families that this president is causing.
Alice, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, some of the criticism of the idea of building a wall has been along the lines of what Alice has been talking about, making the case that, hey, maybe it's more personnel here, maybe it's more screening technology there, and that might be money better spent, is one of the arguments against spending money on the wall, right?
Well, you have heard the president sort of back off this idea of a concrete wall. He's talked about a steel slat fence at some point. Some of his allies, including Mark Meadows, the conservative congressman, have today talked about maybe in some parts of the border it's drone surveillance, so it'd be not necessarily a wall, but a series of drones that would monitor the border. And so it does seem that Trump and his closest allies are backing off this idea of the wall that they had talked so fervently about during the 2016 campaign, and that's probably a sign that Democrats have a much stronger negotiating position at the moment.
Thanks for the call, Alice. We'll go now to Mary Lisa in Green Bay. Mary Lisa, hi.
Hi. Hey, this is, I really liked what your last caller had to say, and I appreciate some information about what is truly needed. I'm absolutely infuriated that the President of the United States is holding the United States of America and 800,000 of its workers and all the people that are connected to them hostage. The man is holding our country hostage. He's negotiating like we've all been kidnapped, and this is his position, and this is what we have to do. And just because, our politicians have had to negotiate and let go of their campaign promises since the founding fathers.
Mary Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, are people in Congress raising the concerns about federal workers either being off the job or being on the job without pay?
Well, I think the members of Congress who have a significant number of federal workers in their districts certainly are. I think a key date to look forward to will be this Friday, when it's actually payday for federal workers. And this will be the first time that the federal workers in this shutdown will not have received a paycheck. And so think about, families, 800,000 federal workers and their families not receiving a paycheck on Friday. If their mortgage is due the following week, that puts them in an incredibly difficult position, barring them having a large amount of savings in the bank. And so I think we're going to, TSA agents who are now working across the country in airports without any pay, there's talk about whether they might walk off the job or call it, or have hundreds more members call in sick, which would really strain the airlines and create havoc at airports around the country, which is needed, obviously, to ensure business runs smoothly throughout the United States. And so these are some of the things that we're watching and we're thinking about. Friday will be a key date.
Let's take one more call on this before we move on to other issues. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi there.
Hello there. I just wanted to comment on the rebuttal by Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer. They looked absolutely horrible. It was, if I was a staffer for either one of them and I put them in front of that podium together like that, I would be fearing for my job today. It was the most awful optics you could ever imagine.
Tom, thanks for the call. Yeah, Scott, the president has an Oval Office as a natural setting. I think there's probably bipartisan consensus that it did, the two people at the podium looked a little awkward.
Oh, yeah, it was derided on Twitter and social media. It was not the best format for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. I think their message was fine, but people were mocking them on social media, and therefore it took a little bit away from their message.
Tom, thanks for the call. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We'll move on to some other issues coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, digging into the week's news in national politics. Now it's the other stuff that isn't border security and the shutdown. Scott, this got kind of, covered up by all this other news, this filing by Paul Manafort. He was, for a while, President Trump's then campaign manager. His lawyers made a filing. They didn't appropriately redact some information, and now we're seeing that Paul Manafort, while he was a campaign chair for Donald Trump, candidate Trump, shared polling information from the campaign with people connected to apparently Russian intelligence. Is this something that people are seeing as a big deal in the ongoing Russian investigation?
Yeah, I think for the people who have been following this case closely, they are saying it's a pretty significant development that Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign chairman, met with this operative, Konstantin Kilimnik, while he was serving in the Trump campaign. And that's significant because Manafort originally had been under scrutiny for tax evasion charges and other offenses before he had joined the Trump campaign, well before, many years before he had joined the campaign. And so now it's clear that Robert Mueller is also zeroing in on some of the activity that Manafort was involved in during his tenure as campaign chairman.
Now, on a related story, Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General, he has been overseeing the Mueller probe for quite a while now. Talking about resigning, according to reports, I'm hearing next month. I'm hearing no, not until the Mueller probe is done, which is who knows how long. What kind of reports are you seeing right now?
Yeah, I'm seeing all of those reports. Nobody really knows the exact date when he will be gone. But he is seen as somebody who is an ally of Robert Mueller, who believes that Robert Mueller's investigation should be completed, despite what the president and the president's allies say. And so I think a lot of people believe it's important for him to remain in place, until we see what Robert Mueller has discovered and what his report might include. And I'm talking to a lot of, Hill lawmakers, and they believe that the Mueller report will be out, within the next month or two. And so they believe it's just around the corner. I think it's pretty safe to say that the Mueller report will come out and, everyone will be able to read it and understand its findings. And so there's not too much concern that Rosenstein leaving would, derail that effort in any way. But he is definitely seen as somebody who believes that Mueller's investigation should be completed and not impeded by the president.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill. He covers congressional leadership there. We're talking about some of the top stories in national news this week. Let's get back into Congress now. House Democratic leaders, the House Rules and Budget Committees, could be holding hearings on the idea of a Medicare for All healthcare system. This is hearings. This is not votes. But what kind of things are we talking about here?
Yeah, that's right. One of the progressive leaders in Congress, Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, announced this week that she had secured support from Nancy Pelosi to get some hearings on Medicare for All in both of the committees that you mentioned, rules and budget. And basically what that means is this issue, will get full hearings. It will be explored. It will be debated, something that has not happened in a decade in Congress, especially under Republican rule. And so it's just another example of how drastically the House has shifted with Democrats taking control of the lower chamber this year, going from, hearings on, Fast and Furious and Obamacare repeal, and all of a sudden they've announced hearings on Medicare for All. And I think this is going to be, this is going to play into the presidential Democratic primary that we're already seeing taking shape. When you have a lot of these candidates who are championing, this effort of universal health care, people like Bernie Sanders, of course, and Elizabeth Warren, who's already entered the race, and perhaps Beto O'Rourke. And so this will just draw more attention provide for more debate on the issue of single-payer health care.
And this is something where, okay, a Republican Senate probably isn't going to vote for a Medicare for all plan. A Republican president probably wouldn't sign it even if they did. But it speaks to, as you were kind of pointing to there, the role of control of the House as kind of a bully pulpit to be able to take agenda items and get them out there in the public eye.
Well, that's right. Yeah, we're not expecting, you know, we're not on the cusp of passage of Medicare for all, but Democrats will be able to say, well, this is what we stand for. You know, however, I will point out that just because you hold hearings doesn't mean it's going to make it even to the floor of the House of Representatives. In fact, some of the health care reporters I was talking to today said it likely will not get a vote in the full House of Representatives. But that's not to say that, you know, progressives who really hold a lot of the power in the Democratic Party won't be putting this issue front and center.
And another kind of message issue, Democrats, their first bill they rolled out in the House of Representatives, this package of bills aimed at cracking down what they're saying is political corruption, looking at things like campaign finance, presidential tax returns, and more. Spell out for us some of the high points or the main points of this package of legislation.
Yeah, it's really, you know, Democrats' own version of drain the swamp. It was their first bill out of the gate, and the one that jumped out at me was really something aimed at President Trump. It would require both the president and the vice president to disclose their finances and tax returns going back for a decade, something that President Trump had refused to do during the campaign and even as president. And so, you know, Democrats believe that they won the House of Representatives back this past cycle by touting this message of anti-corruption, and so they're putting their money where their mouth is and bringing forward this sweeping package, government reform package.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, has he responded to this package?
No, and you know, like most bills that will be passed by the Democratic House, you would expect a lot of them just to be ignored by the Republican-controlled Senate. You know, people are saying there may be a couple areas where they can find bipartisan support and allow something to reach the president's desk. Things like, you know, we've talked in the past, reducing prescription drug prices or infrastructure. But I will say that given where we are with the current shutdown fight, you know, with both sides so dug in, the longer this shutdown fight lasts, and Trump has even threatened to make it last for months or years, the less time there will be for any sort of bipartisan action. And, you know, it continues to engender bad will between the two parties.
And finally and briefly, Scott, in the presidential tweet department, the president had tweeted a threat, it sounds like, that he would order FEMA to stop funding recovery efforts after California wildfires. What was the message there?
Yeah, the president is upset with the new governor, Gavin Newsom, and California officials for not properly, in his words, managing the forests in California. He believes that's the reason why you've seen, you know, this breakout of serious California wildfires, including the one up in Paradise, California, that claimed 85 lives. Democrats, of course, are pointing to climate change and things like drought as the main culprit for this for these types of fires. But the president, you know, according to one Republican congressman who represents that area, said the president is not doing a good job, you know, in terms of explaining the issue. He's conflating land management issues with FEMA funds, you know, by threatening to take away FEMA funds. And this congressman, Doug LaMalfa, told me today that he really was disappointed in the president for threatening to punish people who have just really lost their homes and their livelihoods as a result of this very bad wildfire.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill. He focuses on covering House leadership there. He was with us for a look at the latest in national politics, including where things stand in ending the partial government shutdown.
We'll talk more
about President Trump's address to the nation right after the news. And tomorrow after 4:30, we'll find out what authority the president has to build a wall on the southern border without the approval of Congress.
And coming up on Friday, we are looking at talking about the history of federal government shutdowns, why we have them. Things haven't always worked the way they do now when it comes to shutdowns. Are you looking forward to a total eclipse of the moon? Well, turn around, bright eyes, and mark this date on your calendar, Sunday, January 20th. That night, starting a little after 11:30, the moon will go into the Earth's shadow.
And as reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this isn't just a lunar eclipse. It's also a supermoon, a blood moon, and a wolf moon. That means the moon will be a bit reddish on the closer side to Earth than average, and it falls in a month associated with wolves, as noted by Native Americans.
So it's a super blood wolf total lunar eclipse, which sounds pretty metal to me.
Have you ever watched a lunar eclipse,
Rob? Yeah, there was one a few years ago, the last one I think that we could see here. We took the kids out by a lake and watched it, and I gotta say, it was pretty cool. Like, you know, it changes color for a while, and the moon just kind of disappears. I tried to get pictures of it all for my phone. Yeah, that didn't work out well.
Yeah, so
I could not recreate that experience. Have you seen one of these lunar eclipses?
I did a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh. Probably the same one.
Yeah, it was the same one. And I just went outside and looked up, and me and the kids looked up to see if we could see anything.
Yeah.
It was actually kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. And the clouds held off. Now, solar eclipse, I've seen that there was that big one where you could go south. I watched it from here with the glasses, watching it from this far out. It wasn't that awesome.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. I've had to go south to do it.
All right, we'll watch for those eclipses. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.